Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the Disclosure Podcast. I am your host, Ed. Thank you so much for clicking on today's podcast. I really hope you enjoy it. I'm very excited for this particular podcast as it is an interview with Mike the Vegan, who I've looked up to for a long time and whose work has been invaluable both to myself but also invaluable to the vegan community in general. But we'll talk more about Mike in a minute before we get into the interview. But I just wanted to start by saying that I hope you're all well and I hope you're all safe. We are living through unprecedented times right now and also quite frightening times and for many people, very difficult times. And so I hope that you're safe and I hope that you're able to look after yourselves and I hope that your families and your loved ones are also safe. And hopefully we will begin to see the other side of this soon. So we'll get into this week's podcast episode, which is related to the pandemic and related in general to animal exploitation and the pandemic, touching on those topics. But before we get into it, I just wanted to say a couple of things. The first thing is, if you have listened to the Disclosure podcast before, maybe you're a regular listener, and maybe you've enjoyed the podcasts, then it would be great if you could leave a review on iTunes, because it allows more people to come across the podcast and encourages more people to listen to it. So if you're able to leave a review on iTunes, then that would mean the world to me and I would greatly appreciate it. As well as that, I also do a monthly patron-only podcast, which is like a Q&A. So Patreon is where you can sign up to support my activism work, and through doing so, you can access this monthly Q&A podcast where my patrons ask me a range of different questions related to all things vegan, and I hopefully give insightful and thoughtful answers to those questions. We had some really, really great questions, and they're always quite interesting, both for me and hopefully for the listeners as well. And we also do have a Discord server as well, so my patrons and I, we can all chat amongst each other and share articles and resources and help each other out with any vegan dilemmas that we're facing with our friends, family, or just in general society. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get access to that through my Patreon, which you can find also through my website as well. But let's get into this week's podcast, or into this episode of the Disclosure podcast. For those of you who don't know already, Mike the Vegan is an incredibly influential vegan advocate. He has a very successful YouTube channel. But bigger than that, he's just a very well-researched, a very thoughtful, a very intelligent vegan communicator who bases his arguments in fact, in science, and in very well-established and respectable scientific studies. His topics are really about the positive health effects of a vegan diet, as well as the negative environmental impact of eating animal products and the sociological phenomenon of casual animal exploitation. He's based in the US, but he tackles and debunks vegan issues from all around the world, and he really takes on these myths that perpetuate harmful dietary and lifestyle behavior. So I really would recommend checking him out and engaging with his content, because for me personally, I've learned so much from watching Mike's content, and I know that many, many, many others have. And his approach and the way he conducts himself really leaves others, those that are often against veganism, with no wiggle room, because it's so grounded in, well, not just common sense, but also the scientific studies to support what Mike talks about in his videos. Well, I really hope you enjoy this week's episode, and here it is. So hi, Mike. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me as well. I greatly appreciate it, and I know that there's a lot of things we can talk about today, so we'll try and cover some of those big issues as best as we can. But yeah, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's so cool that we're able to do this. I mean, we're not really able to see anybody in person, but at least we can do this, right?
So the wonders of modern technology, right?
Yeah.
It's great. Well, the first thing I wanted just to say was, I suppose thank you, but thank you for the video you did just last week. But thank you for all of your work in general. It's wonderful to be able to connect to you properly. We've met before, but we've never
briefly.
Yeah. So it's nice to be able to properly chat about these things. But yeah, thank you for that video. I appreciate it, and it illuminated me in terms of things that I've not thought about as well.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to come in there and defend the Ed for a second, because I haven't really, honestly, I was surprised that I hadn't really had a chance to talk about you yet. And like, I mentioned you several times briefly in a video, but I never done like a full Earthling Ed related video, but that gave me the opportunity. So I was like, all right, I'm doing it.
Well, I appreciate it. It's good. Sure. I mean, I think it's a great place to start talking about the USA Today situation. I mean, it's progressed so much more since then. It was an article, I think, in the New York Times a day or two ago, talking about the link between animal exploitation and, of course, zoonotic disease. And so it has broadened out a lot since then. But why do you think that at the beginning with the USA Today article, why was there kind of that initial skepticism around what we as vegans often talk about when it comes to this?
You know, it's hard for me to tell what percent of it is skepticism and what percent of it is like seizing an opportunity, like a media journalistic opportunity that they know can spread and people will, you know, because it's the old people love to hate vegans and he'll hear good news about their bad habits. So it's just one more way to reinforce that you don't need to go vegan during this whole epidemic because it didn't cause this crisis. And so I don't know if that's it. That's maybe it. Or it's just the fact that people want, they also have, they're contributing because of their habits to it, and they want to, for their own sake, find some wiggle room and so that they can say the vegans are wrong and so what I'm doing is fine, and so they could maybe think, oh, it's impossible to know, was kind of their answer, right? It's impossible to know what caused this thing. Yeah. Therefore, you're wrong, which I talked about was a logical fallacy, appeal to ignorance fallacy as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a dangerous way of thinking to say it's impossible to know, because most things are impossible, nearly everything's impossible to know. But of course, we don't look at science or look at kind of laws of physics and say, well, it's impossible to know either way, so therefore we should just discount it as being true in the slightest. It's dangerous.
And that's why I went through the probability angle of like, oh, science goes off probability because we can't know everything. And just looking at the numbers of 70 billion animals, land animals a year being raised and slaughtered, and then people not realizing that we have at least 20,000 of these wild, quote-unquote, wild animal farms. Mm. So these are farmed animals, even though they're species that are considered to be wild and not domesticated. And that's a $70 billion industry, and most people aren't aware of that. So you have this massive reservoir where you can have a host that can transfer a bat virus, for example.
Obviously, what we're talking about now, right, is banning wet markets in China, or banning the wildlife trade in China. Mm. But the thing is, we're kind of missing a bigger point, obviously, which is that when we talk about live animal markets, it's not just in China. You know, we're missing such a big part of the problem by just singling out Chinese culture and saying, oh, well, it's wrong to sell live animals there, but live animals in, well, wherever it might be, California or London or wherever it might be, is absolutely fine.
And they're selling live animals, but then there's also just having massive farms with a ton of live animals. And we can talk about the Spanish flu later, but just that people think it's from Spain, it wasn't. It was most likely, all signs are pointing to a Kentucky chicken farm. Yeah. And so right now I see people going and eating chicken and feeling completely fine about it. And that killed 50 million people.
50, and exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was only about 2 to 2.5% fatality rate, which is actually really small. And so if we had a virus that came along that had, you know, even just a 5 or 10% fatality rate, then you can imagine just the devastation that would cause.
Yeah, if MERS, for example, which is the Middle Eastern one, which is another coronavirus, which transferred through camels, if that happened again on a larger scale or became more contagious, that had a 35% mortality rate based off the cases that we know. So maybe it was a little bit lower than that, but still, that's insanely high. If that was contagious...
Yeah, well, now, let's say we have a situation where we have like a H5N1 or a highly pathogenic and highly dangerous strain of avian influenza, there's a fatality rate of 40% or 50%, which is absolutely within the realms of possibility. And you're talking about a highly globalized world with a spread of something that's as pathogenic as the common cold, but with a fatality rate of 50%. I mean, that's the end of civilization as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be horrible, and it's so preventable. There's absolutely zero requirement for people to be farming these animals. Yeah. And yet, of course, we're going to keep doing it. Hopefully not for long. But
Well, do you think that this situation will change the broader mentality of society? Do you have hope?
Well, it depends on how good of a job USA Today and these other people do. You know, if they get the idea out there that there is no, you know, that a vegan world wouldn't save it, or wouldn't prevent this from happening, then they're going to feel fine doing exactly what they're doing. They're going to say, no, that problem's over there in China. That's separate from me. That's separate from what I buy at the grocery store. Even though it's not, and it's not impossible. There's one thing that I've been looking into, and we don't have an answer yet. We won't have an answer until late April as to whether or not this can infect pigs. There's a pretty good sort of hint at it based off a previous SARS study, SARS-1, where they infected pigs, and they weren't showing massive symptoms, but they were showing antibodies so that it was clearly attacking their system, or it was in their system enough for them to fight it. And that was only on 6 pigs. So if we have, obviously, you know, I'm actually in Iowa where there's more pigs than people by a factor of 7, more pigs than any other state. Yeah, it's insane. And so this could potentially be the epicenter. And the 2 counties over from me, they have a higher rate of this than New York as a state, which isn't as high as New York City, but it's all from a single slaughterhouse that was slaughtering pigs. And so the question is, as we see all these slaughterhouses across the U.S. closing, which is what I'm going to talk about in my next video, is it affecting these pigs, or is it just that the slaughterhouse conditions are so inhumane and the workers are treated so horribly that it's why it can spread like wildfire? I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, I saw an article, I think it was written by Grain. I think they're like a non-profit. I'm not entirely sure what their work is. But they were talking about how, because we know it starts off in a bat, but we don't know what the intermediary animal was before it to get to a human. You could speculate that it could have come from a pig still. Like, we think maybe a pangolin, but we can't necessarily write off, you know, conventionally farmed animals. So there is every chance still, until we know further, obviously, that this particular coronavirus could have originated from a pig, or at least could have gone through a pig to get to us, not originated.
Pigs were at the Wuhan wet market, I'm pretty sure. I mean, they were definitely at least being slaughtered there. And there's pretty good indication that this can spread through like dry dust, fecal matter dust. So it could have literally been from pigs from that. And a second one is, look, it's infecting. They found it infected a Bengal tiger. It infects pangolins, is what they think is the intermediary animal. It has the closest, the virus they found in them has the closest protein match to any, you know, to the virus compared to any other animal, closer than the bat one. Mm. And obviously can infect bats. So we've got this whole spread. And you're telling me that this animal that we can put a heart valve in a human with is not going to be able to be infected, at least to some way? Maybe not. Maybe we're lucky. And maybe that's not the case. But I think it's leaning in that direction based off how all of these slaughterhouses that are slaughtering pigs are getting it. Maybe it's not. I hope it's not that, because that's even one more level of this that's a problem. But in the end, if we find out it is that, then at least people can go, hey, what we're eating here in the U.S., in the rest of the world, is causing the issue. So,
I mean, another, to add a bit more weight to the argument, there was the coronavirus SADS, wasn't there, which was in China, I think a few years ago, that never went to humans, but was in pigs. So that was a coronavirus that they found in pigs.
Oh, there's a ton. In fact, there was actually a coronavirus vaccine picture going around. It said coronavirus vaccine, but the reality is it was a cattle vaccine, because there's so many animal-based coronavirus. In fact, there's a direct quote from one of these like animal, you know, livestock articles I'll cover in my video. It says that the industry is very familiar with the term coronavirus, because these are infect animals so much.
So it's something the industry's had to deal with before, right?
Yeah, it's just a matter of whether it's like SARS, if whether it can infect humans. Luckily, those don't. Like, I'm pretty sure that cattle one doesn't. Hmm. The cow one, I like calling them cows. So hopefully cows aren't also part of the equation. I don't think they are. We don't think that chickens are, because I think they tested chickens.
And then, but the problem with chickens is, of course, the bird flu, which is potentially even more of a risk factor than a coronavirus would normally be. And in fact, I saw it just a couple of days ago. I don't know if I sent you the article. I'm not sure if you saw it, but it was talking about how in South Carolina they found a very highly pathogenic form of bird flu, which was similar to the one they found on the East Coast, I think, in 2015, where they had to, well, I say they had to, where they then euthanized, or we should say slaughtered, tens of millions of birds as a result of that. And so it's already, these strains of influenza that potentially could pass into humans at some point are existing in society all around us all the time.
Yeah, we're constantly on the edge. And another thing, speaking of euthanization, I was just reading about all the slaughterhouses that are shutting down. They are starting to euthanize the animals because they don't have anything to do with them, which is ridiculous. If you think about it, it's like they probably, because it's too expensive to keep feeding them, and then they end up killing these animals, which is, you know, a whole nother level of tragedy. Obviously, they were going to be killed anyway, which is horrible, but it's like, because this whole business is shutting down. I mean, anyway, I could ramble about that for a while, but it's just one more level of travesty.
But I think it's interesting. I looking into the dairy industry, I know the dairy industry in the US is asking for a stimulus package as well. And they've done the same in the UK, asking for like more subsidies, even though they obviously take a fair few already. Ridiculous. So they're asking for more taxpayers' money to keep them afloat.
And demand goes down.
Even as demand goes down. Yeah. And there was one, I don't know what the organization or the company that the overarching company was, but it might have been Danone or Muller, maybe. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But they were saying that the dairy farmers, and it was really, really deceitful, the words they were using, they should retire parts of the herd early.
Wow.
To cut down costs. I thought, retire.
Oh, like, man. The words. Yeah. Oh, man. They get so bad. Oh.
It's terrible, isn't it? So it is happening right now. Farmers are culling and, you know, murdering these animals to cut down costs. And I suppose it must be happening with pigs as well, of course, like you say.
Yeah,
it is.
How far can we remove ourselves from what we're actually doing to animals?
Yeah. Like, this slaughterhouse thing is an interesting one because I don't know if it's happened so much here, but I've seen in the US. I mean, I know Smithfields have closed their big slaughterhouse in South Dakota, I think it is.
Yeah, which actually has like 30-40% of all of the cases in that state. Right. And probably the rest of the cases came from that as well, most of them.
Which is crazy. And to think that we have this whole system right now where we have these so-called key workers, and, you know, for the most part that system makes sense. But then we have these slaughterhouse workers who we're calling key workers, but really what they are is they're exploited workers who are forced to continue doing their job because the companies that own these slaughterhouses are refusing to close them because of demand. So we have this whole system of exploitation. Then we have these slaughterhouse workers who are so disregarded that they're working in these incredibly dangerous environments. But they're dangerous anyway, one of the most dangerous places to work at any time, but are highly dangerous now because of what's happening. And they can't abide by social distancing. They're impoverished people that are now having to kill animals over and over again and put themselves at risk. And we're seeing the consequence of that, just so much exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a human rights issue as well. And then I would also add, it's interesting because whenever you see footage of a slaughterhouse, maybe these are just better equipped slaughterhouses than other people are, actually tend to wear masks. They tend to wear some type of protection, and it's probably not the case for the ones that are getting, you know, completely infected. But it makes me wonder if there really is another animal-based means of it being spread. For example, like dust, fecal matter dust, or something that's really fine that's getting in, because there's a lot of workplaces that are still inhumane that are going on. I mean, you've got vegetable farming. People are vegetable farming, and they're in vegetable packing plants, not vegetable slaughterhouses, shoulder to shoulder. And why aren't we seeing the largest, you know, maybe it's just a smaller industry, but why aren't we seeing breakouts there? Why aren't we seeing breakouts? Sorry, my headphones are being like rejected by my ears. Why aren't we seeing more issues in other places that are just poor workplaces that are quote unquote essential? And it makes me wonder, like, why are all these slaughterhouses having to close? The list is getting longer and longer and longer, and it's dominating the cases in states, which is, I don't know, maybe I want to be wrong. I want to be like, okay, it is just poor human conditions, which is bad enough as it is. Mm-hmm. But if it's poor human conditions, plus some type of like aerosolized dried fecal matter dust from pig feces or something like that, that's doing it. Like, that's just, that's a whole nother level. I mean, basically at the end of the day, we're fighting a ridiculous uphill battle if we want to keep eating animal products in terms of this. And right now, I mean, right now it's the largest threat. You know, before I make the health argument of like, hey, heart disease is the number one killer. And maybe it still is in, you know, globally, but in the US, coronavirus has officially passed heart disease deaths. And so now the biggest threat to humanity is diseases that come directly from animal farming that are not, because I used to, you know, it used to be a secondary argument for me, like, oh, you know, and I do still want people to eat healthy and treat themselves well and reverse their diseases, which is still huge and improve their quality of life. But it's like, if our number one threat, even more existential, our number one threat is infectious diseases from animal farming, then that's another huge argument. And especially because people already don't want to listen so much.
I guess it plays into two ways. This pandemic has been so devastating from the economy, for people's personal, social lives, saying, look, we don't want this to happen again. So actually not eating animal products is a small sacrifice now compared to the sacrifices that we're all making right now.
Yeah.
But then I think the other side of that is people are going to be even more ardently against listening to us because there's that stubbornness. It's like a petulant child who just doesn't want to listen to the voice of reason because
it becomes more and more right every week.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. But it is an interesting situation we find ourselves in. And I think we're at that crossroads now where I think we've almost been given a chance. I guess what I mean by that is this is a terrible situation, but it could have been a lot worse. And so we've been given almost an opportunity to assess and change to try and stop something like this happening again. But the real question is whether or not we're going to do that. And I can't quite find the confidence to say that we are. I'm not sure. Where do you lie on that?
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. But I first just want to say I majorly agree that this is like a warning shot fired against the bow of humanity right now. you know, the flu often kills 60,000 people in the U.S. every year. I pray that we're not going to get over that. Obviously, we would probably have gone way past that if we weren't doing all these measures. So I don't want to say that it's, you know, less threatening than your average flu. I think there are going to be people, maybe 10% of people. If at the end of this, we can go, this came from animal farming, diseases like this have a major connection. And there are enough major news organizations that are doing an honest job of covering it and just mentioning the animal farming connection. Mm-hmm. That I think maybe 10% of people might be a little bit more open to it, but we have to just reach that tipping point.
Yeah. Well, we do have to definitely. And the United Nations has said, it was just kind of alluding to what you said earlier about how it is such a big risk, but it's something we don't often think about. But I think the United Nations has said that the two biggest risks to human health, or the, you know, to global human health, would be climate change and pandemics. Yeah. And then, ironically, we can significantly reduce, you know, the impact of both of them by becoming vegan, right? And not only that, you've got the chronic disease element. It's this huge umbrella of issues that if we all made a simple change in our lives, we could easily reduce, if not eliminate in part, so much of these problems. And it feels like we're just constantly having to bang the drum on it, but maybe, just maybe, this could be that little push for, as you say, potentially 10%.
It is possible because this really has just affected everybody's life. You know, there are so many people who are just like alone in isolation right now. Their lives are ruined in their minds. I mean, obviously, you know, compare it to like solitary confinement or something like that, it's nothing. Or compare it to what an animal goes through, it's nothing. But I think it's possibly going to be enough that if the case can be made strongly, and especially if by the end of this, there is a mainstream Western animal agriculture connection. You know, if you say illegal trafficking of pangolins and bats in China did it, like, that might at least open people's eyes a little bit to, okay, there's an animal connection. Yeah. But that's not the animals I eat. But if at the end of this, that pig connection does exist, which I'm skeptical of, but if it does exist, then that's huge. And then of course, if people can make the connection between the next big pig, swine, or avian flu, then that'll be good. But we'll see. It depends on public health communicators that we have, how biased they are personally against this. People who are in charge are, you know, are going to be the ones that are going to determine whether or not the public shifts their patterns. But the reality is, the same people that do that, you know, they're part of the same organization that gets paid by lobbyists that are from the animal industry, you know, connected to, you know, the beef checkoff and the egg board and all of these animal exploitation industries that want to keep business as usual, and they want to increase their business, which is clinically insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, like, the CDC, have you heard any murmurings from them? Have they talked about the animal link? Is Dr. Ooh. Fauci talking about it?
No, they're not. I mean, Dr. Fauci is probably just too busy walking on eggshells. Yeah,
just eggshells.
Yeah. To think about eggs and their connection to it. So we'll see. Maybe at the end of this, there will be. But honestly, it's all the more reason that vegans have to be a loud voice, because they're the only ones that are willing to talk about it right now. And of course, we'll be annoying. It'll be one more reason vegans are annoying, but it'll be one more reason that vegans are right. Because if it's just the fact that right now, it looks like if China was vegan, this wouldn't happen. Even if the world was vegan, obviously it wouldn't. So
we talk about farming and the links that has to exploiting animals, but as the climate changes, and I guess also the climate change, we have changes in society, so we're going to have more people, right? So there's going to be 10 billion humans in 30 years time, so that's another 2 billion or so humans, which means at the levels that we currently eat animal products, we're going to have shifted the industry by another 20%. So that's 20% more animals, 20% more farms, 20% more risk of these infectious diseases. And so as we continue, if we don't get a hold on it now, it's only going to get worse and worse and worse, because the systems that we've created are going to keep expanding because we're expanding.
I mean, there's one answer that may or may not happen, and I don't know your thought about it, but guess what doesn't have a respiratory system that also produces meat, lab-grown meat? I mean, it could be the solution. I mean, it's honestly, I think if anything is going to get pushed hard in terms of an industry shift, it's going to be more of an argument for those companies to be pushing the legislation through to allow lab-grown meat to happen, because you're going, there's basically a 0% chance. I mean, maybe there's going to be some sort of like flesh-eating infection, but then again, they're sealed in, but there's going to be no respiratory infections. There's going to be no digestive-based infections that could come out of this, because those systems don't exist in cell-cultured meat. So,
and I guess cell-cultured meat is going to be the solution to so many of these issues, yeah. Environmental, ethical. I suppose when that happens, we need to make sure that it applies somewhat globally, I guess, because another problem we have is human populations increase. It's not just about farming, it's about deforestation. And I guess particularly in places across Asia or Africa, where some of the most destructive diseases like Ebola or Nipah or these ones exist, as we encroach more into those wild territories, maybe it's expansion of urban life, but probably an expansion for agriculture, then we also increase that risk. And so it becomes that geopolitical issue of making sure we're tackling all these different areas of the issue.
Yeah, and it's frustrating. Yeah, it's extra frustrating because I saw an article being like, oh, it's actually, you know, deforestation and destroying habitats that caused the virus. And nowhere in that did it mention that, you know, a leading cause, if not the leading cause of deforestation, depending on the area of the world, is animal agriculture. So basically, you have articles like that one who are just entirely, as a separate issue, blaming our destruction of wild habitats, which is obviously a problem. And we have 15 times as much farmed animal biomass as we have wild animal biomass. That's all a huge issue. But to completely forget that we are deforesting, you know, by far at least 80% of Amazon destruction is from animal agriculture. And it also depends, like, what, and it's also hunting too. That's what caused HIV to transfer to humans, was that monkey hunter who had a cut and killed that monkey and got monkey blood on them. And so we don't even know what the next, like, there could be a disease that we can't even comprehend yet that's going to come from a chimpanzee hunter or someone like that. So we just have to stop hurting these animals, stop exploiting these animals, and it would help. It would help. Simple vegan argument.
It would definitely help. I think that's one of the things that frustrated me in the USA Today article was they listed like all these different things. Oh, it could be to do with like the pet industry, or it could be to do with hunting. And I was like, well, all of these things wouldn't exist in a vegan world. So it's so annoying that what people, I think a lot of the argument has come down to people saying, oh, vegans are saying it's about eating meat, or it's about eating bats, and it's about eating pangolins. It's like, it's not about the physical consumption. It's about the whole system of exploitation that
it's
increases.
It's about the using of animals. And I love how, oh man, the second one that attacked you that I talked about, the Popular Science one, which was literally in the title, said a vegan world, like when it saw this, it was listed as the reasons we would still, this shows how deeply they thought about this, reasons we would still be like having a lot of contact with animals in a vegan world, riding horses. Are you joking me?
Yeah, I saw that in your video. Maybe, yeah, there must, but I guess that partly the problem is people's lack of understanding about what veganism is still. And there must be, I guess maybe in our own bubbles, we have this awareness that everyone knows that, oh, of course, riding horses would be not exist in a vegan world. And of course, we would have exotic pets or, you know, wild animals as pets. And then all of a sudden, maybe that's part of the problem, a lack of definition for people.
Yeah. And just a lack of understanding of the scale of animal agriculture, because we hide it. And we hide it through behind those euphemisms they were talking about, that what they use for slaughter. What was it again?
Yeah, retiring.
Retire. Wow.
Sinister, isn't it? One thing I know that you've discussed before, and I very much doubt there's any data on this, or at least not at the moment. It probably won't ever be. Do you think that by eating like a whole food plant-based diet, we are reducing our risk of getting something like COVID-19?
Oh, it's so obvious. And I talked about this. I didn't want to do a repeat video, but I made a video about coronavirus survival before we had a lot of data in the U.S., and it turns out that about 90% of people who died in the U.S. from this disease had a pre-existing condition, meaning heart disease or diabetes or hypertension, things that we can reverse with a whole food vegan diet. I mean, especially things like hypertension that are just so immediate, they go down so fast that you have to be careful if you're taking high blood pressure medicine. Because your blood pressure will crash too far. It'll try to stabilize, and then the medicine will push it too far. Things like that. And then, of course, you know, we have Dr. Esselstyn's clinical trial showing the reversal of heart disease. Mm-hmm. We have Dr. Barnard's showing the reversal of diabetes. And then we have, you know, just in terms of blood flow, if you can increase your blood flow, you know, this is the way people die from this, is their lungs basically can't get oxygen. Their lungs can't bring oxygen to their bloodstream because of the level of severe inflammation, which, again, vegans have. If you take somebody and put them on a vegan diet, their inflammation level lowers by 30%. So right there, we have at least a little bit better of a chance of survival, theoretically. Mm-hmm. But then the idea is, if you have some atherosclerosis in your, you know, pulmonary artery and your lung vessels, like, what are your chances of survival compared to somebody who doesn't have that? That's how much oxygen can get through. And then things like, you know, pulmonary disease have connections to diet as well. And it's just that inflammation. You know, this is, they call it the cytokine storm, which is, you know, inflammatory proteins getting in there, creating debris, blocking things up. And imagine just having even 30% less of those from going, as someone that goes vegan. Somebody, in fact, I'll give a little teaser here. I got some blood tests done and my inflammation level was the lowest detectable amount, which I don't know how often they see that. And maybe that's just, I'm lucky in addition to being vegan, but I don't even know if we have a really good study showing your average vegan levels versus normal. We only have that study really showing if you put people on a vegan diet, what their, how theirs drops by 30%. But, you know, if we have 200 or 300 people eating a healthy vegan diet or even a fully whole food vegan diet, seeing that inflammation level would be a huge argument, because if it is 10 times lower, which mine might actually be, than the average person, then we're talking about potentially, maybe even if it's only half the risk of death, even though it probably is like five times less, where, you know, we have another big argument for why people should be eating this way.
Not only would, if in the vegan world we have less risk of these epidemics and pandemics and outbreaks from starting, but even in the case where they did, depending on, of course, completely depending on what type of illness they were, we could potentially build up a better immune system to stop it from spreading as quickly in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. And that doesn't even get into, I don't even get into the immune system itself, which I would want to do proper research, but that's probably going to be one of my next videos. But I mean, it's pretty obvious.
It's an interesting issue to talk about because it's also inextricably linked together.
We're now putting together the full three-part system of not being vegan created the virus in the first place. Not being vegan, you know, these slaughterhouses in terms of the system is appears to be one of the main spreads of the disease, at least in the U.S. right now, you know, past just extremely dense cities. And then we have how people eat, eating those animals, making them less able to fight the infection that was spread and then caused initially by animal exploitation. So it's a full triforce of vegan resistance.
And then we have this ironic situation where people are flocking to Walmart, flocking to whatever, you know, supermarket, Tesco's here in the UK, stockpiling on chicken breasts, on pork loins, and perpetuating a system that's increasing the spread of more different types of zoonotic diseases in the first place. And potentially the diseases that are now being created because of our stockpiling of these meats is even potentially worse than the one that we're stockpiling to protect ourselves from.
And I'm sure there's somebody out there who's probably gone home and eaten a lot more animal products even since they've started this and probably raised their cholesterol. Like it's so ironic. The whole thing is so ironic. And I just hope that somehow we can get like wide scale, like global public clarity on what is actually causing this and how to prevent the next bigger one, because there obviously will be a next bigger one.
Certainly so. And that's the problem, isn't it? It's not a matter of you know, if, it's a matter of when. And it's only a matter of when, really, until we have something that is more in alignment with the Spanish flu of 1918.
Something I really hope I'm wrong about is that we have so many people with this, like, again, it comes down to animal products, like, or just unhealthy lifestyle. Like, I'm not going to say no vegan has this, but just, like, a constant level of congestion, like dairy. Like, I used to wake up every day when I ate dairy with, like, a stuffed nose and like, certain, you know, nasal issues. And, of course, they've gone away, thankfully, since eating dairy. But there are people that just are walking around all the time with, like, rundown immune systems. They've got a slightly leaky nose just all the time, probably having immune responses to dairy proteins and things like that. So I don't know for 100% sure. Maybe somebody knows out there that these people who are completely asymptomatic are completely asymptomatic, especially the people who were tested initially, people who weren't reporting any, you know, because reporting a symptom means you're kind of reporting a new symptom, right? If you're somebody who has a little bit of a runny nose, which would be enough to wipe on your hand and wipe on the office meeting desk and then spread to a bunch of people, which was one of those first spread points, was an office meeting. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'm wrong about, it's another thing I hope I'm wrong about, but just when you're talking about a population where 50% of people have coronary lesions on their arteries based off autopsies, and a lot of people are just walking around with like post-nasal drip and like just a little sore throat that's like recurring and things like that, you could have a respiratory virus and be asymptomatic on paper, because you don't have a fever or some new symptom. You don't have a really runny nose.
So many of the symptoms are so normalized within people because of pre-existing conditions or because of lifestyle traits. Even those who are only asymptomatic in the context of how poor everyone's health is in our current society.
Exactly.
Wow. I hope you are wrong, but
it's scary. I hope I'm wrong too. Yeah, because it's. I mean, I'd be comforting though to know that if you had somebody who was legit, in reality, it doesn't matter because if somebody who thinks they're asymptomatic is still spreading it, even if they have symptoms, they're still going to spread it. But it would be comforting to know that if you do get the virus, that you have something going on. Like, if you have a completely clear nasal passage with no cough, no fever, and no sore throat or anything like that, then you don't have the virus. That'd be nice to know.
One thing you'd alluded to was, I guess in humans, was that kind of like immunosuppressive problem. In society, I guess a lot of us are stressed anyway, but within animals, because of the way that we treat them, their system is always in this kind of like immunosuppressive state because of the high levels of stress that we put them under. And I guess another factor in terms of like the risk of spread is because we incarcerate these animals in such a way that creates so much stress in their bodies to begin with. I guess it's like with the Spanish flu, and we should call it the 1918 flu, with the trenches and the fact that these soldiers during the First World War were so stressed and their bodies so depleted, it just allowed for the virus to spread so quickly.
I was going to say some target strong immune systems too, which is scary. But you know, we should just rebrand it as the 1918 chicken flu. I also want to call it the U.S. bird flu too, because we just love to say the China virus, the Chinese. It's over there. It's not us. It has nothing to do with us. We're just victims of these animal viruses. It's like, no, the same product that you just paid to buy is what caused 50 million deaths.
And also even more recently than that, the swine flu pandemic, which was U.S., you know, created in U.S. farms, which wiped out globally up to 500,000 people.
Yeah. And we're only talking about viruses. We're not even talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
I've spoken about antibiotic resistance before, but I always have this thought in my head, like, surely it won't get to that. You know, surely we won't go back, you know, 100 years or however long it was just before we got antibiotics. Surely that won't happen again.
Well, I mean, antibiotic resistance can bring us back down to virtually no antibiotics in a couple decades. Hopefully it won't. But it could. And again, like you said, if we have even like a 20% mortality flu or something, that's like, if you don't have a hospital that you have access to, hospitals might as well have not been invented yet. Technology wise, you're going all the way back to not the Stone Age, but somewhere in between. So
the argument around whether or not we should not or use animals is so persuasively stacked in favor of not using animals. Mm-hmm. And yet we rely on such archaic kind of, pre-existing, I guess, fears, pre-existing, I don't want to use the word conditions, but these like deeply inherent justifications that even when viewed in the spectrum of all the reasons we should stop, hold so much more power to people than even like antibiotic resistance, you know, viruses, chronic health disease, what we do to animals, the environment. Literally all of human civilization could end at any point because of what we do to animals.
Yeah.
And yet we still say, oh, well, I like the taste of bacon more than the risk of swine flu or KFC.
Yeah, exactly. And even when you say you love animals, yeah, it's cultural. It's the fact that you're telling an animal, which is a human, that you're going to take away a decent portion of their calories, but one of the most calorie dense foods they eat. You know, it's a lot of things that come together, and it's frustrating. But it is pretty clearly cultural, because you know, within the vegan culture, people are like, fine, not eating it. So obviously, there isn't a drive so deep that people have to eat it. So it's pretty frustrating, and I really hope that people can just open their mind a little bit and we can change the culture. And that's what vegans are doing right now. They're changing, getting those plant-based products into like Burger King and changing the paradigm step by step. It's just a little piecemeal process, and hopefully, you know, this could be one of those straws that doesn't break the camel's back. I don't know who the vegan version of that is.
No, I'm not sure. We'll leave it there, because we've talked about such a range of different issues, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it. So thank you for doing that.
It was great to talk to you. I went even further in all sorts of directions than I thought I would. So yeah. good to hear your perspective. Love it.
That's cool, man. All right, well, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing your next round of content regarding the things we've spoken about. I look forward to seeing the Slaughterhouse one. I think it's a really important issue, and I think it's something we're not hearing enough about. I mean, we're hearing about it, but at the same time, there's such a focus on like farmers having financial problems and farmers being, you know, the victims in this. And I feel like there is that huge thing in the middle, which is the people that we don't ever like to talk about, the people that do the work that the farmers don't want to do and we as consumers don't want to do.
It's being framed more of as a, as a meat shortage than anything else, potential meat shortage, which hasn't happened yet. But anyway, yeah. You could watch my video on it later. But sounds excellent. Thanks so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.